Okay, so we are on lesson 6, and this is the oneness of covenant. I'm just going to make sure. Now it's just solid red. Is that right?
Yeah, okay, right. That's right.
All right. Yeah. Thank you for noticing that. That's all I needed.
That's her job.
I know. It's really helpful to have other people with eyes on what we're doing and what I'm forgetting. I appreciate that. So thanks, Angela. All right, so today we're going to just dip our toes into the Davidic covenant. And I'm going to go where you have not gone in your homework at all. For some reason, the precept homework doesn't touch on the Davidic covenant, which I think is really odd. Just like it doesn't touch on the Adamic covenant. That I understand because there's a lot of theologians that don't. But the Davidic covenant is really important. And it really helps us to recognize God as king. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today, and then we'll talk more about it next week with some of the stories about David. So she does talk about David a lot, but she doesn't connect it to the covenant. So we need to know that. So the Davidic covenant is found in 1 Samuel, or 2 Samuel 7, but also Psalm 89. And that's where it says, this is the covenant I've made with David. Which is really interesting because Psalm 89 is not a Davidic covenant. It's actually Ethan. It's an Ethan psalm. But it talks about how God has made a covenant with David and that it's a perpetual covenant. So what we've noticed is that each phase of the covenant, let me put this back up here again. Each phase of the covenant has led the people into a higher level of commitment. So as they started out, there's first of all just a small amount of people, and then a little bit more people, and a little bit more. But each time the people expand, God also gives them a new status and expands their commitment, which means their commitment is their responsibilities in a relationship, right? And it expands their commitment. There's a more and more deeper commitment to depend, to have a relationship, depend on God, to be partners in his plan. Last week we talked about them being loyal sons, a holy nation, to be a holy nation, a nation who actually is involved in practicing that perichoretic union with one another and with God. But today we get into the Davidic covenant, and we've really got an even much higher commitment because now they're a nation, and now they're in the land. But what God does with covenant is not only give them a deeper level of commitment to covenant, but he also gives them a more tangible and integrated helper. And I'm putting that in quotes because I think that helps us also to see that as each of the heads of the covenant are types of Christ, we also see Christ's spirit coming out here too, this helper kind of thing. And we'll see that a lot in the Davidic covenant with the idea of revealing God as king. So when we talk about the covenant revealing God as king, we talk about the fact that God does that through an actual earthly king. But he does it, first of all, by naming David in this covenant in a father-son relationship. So in the ancient Near East, sonship was a big deal. Sons, first of all, customarily did what their fathers did vocationally. We've got to step away again from our Western culture to think about what do we think? We think, our biggest ideal is I get to do whatever I want to do, right? Mm-hmm. But that was not an ideal in the ancient Near Eastern culture. People would have thought, what's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. Like, why can't you be? This is what you were made for. You were made for that. So your father kind of determined what you were going to be, and it was passed down from generation to generation, which is why last names were so much tied to what they did, right? So if your last name was Carpenter, well, that meant your families were carpenters throughout the generations. So all of us have some kind of root somewhere in our family tree that tells what our family was. The name Fecht actually means to fence. Oh. And I don't mean putting fences. I mean, it actually means this, right?
Oh.
To fence, that kind of fencing. So all of your names had that background in them somewhere. And that was because sons took on the vocation of their fathers. That was the norm. And in that, sons also were meant to display the characteristics of their father, passed on from their family setting and their upbringing and their genetics. Of course, they wouldn't have thought anything about genetics, but they would have understood, you act like that because your father acts like that. And that would have been, so even more than today, I mean, today we still have, parents still have that feeling, right? Like, don't do that, you embarrass me because you're doing that, or I'm so proud of my kid because he's doing that. In those days, that was just assumed. Well, you act like that because your parents act like that. You're kind because your parents are kind. You've learned that in your family upbringing. So that whenever they talked about sonship, particularly when it was talking about the king, sonship actually meant to possess the characteristics of the father. Mm-hmm. So that's what sonship really was talking about, is possessing the characteristics of the father. So when God calls David into this covenant with him, and he calls him his son, and he calls Solomon and all his descendants his son, he's saying to them, he's giving them a status of, you're going to be king so that you would reveal my characteristics, and my characteristics specifically in the way you rule. When it came to the father was the one who gifted them the son. He gifted the son with his vocation. He would gift the son with his good characteristics, and hopefully not pass on the bad characteristics. And what we see with God and David is God gives David this base, this family base from which David can go out into the world, because he gives him experiences of faithfulness. God shows himself faithful to David. Think about David's life before he becomes king. Right, he's the one who calls David out of being a shepherd. He's the least in his family. Remember that a shepherd was considered what we consider maybe a garbage picker today. I mean, a shepherd was the lowest. So God chooses him from being a shepherd amongst all of the handsome, tall, older sons of Jesse. But then he also brings him. He makes him a great warrior, but he also makes him safe throughout all the times that David is running away from Saul, right? So we have lots and lots of different ways that God shows his faithfulness to David. All of that faithfulness in the midst of very hard circumstances, in the midst of circumstances that David didn't choose and yet were difficult for him, because he always seemed to be on the side of like people looking at him like, what's going on with you? In fact, even the army that comes alongside him when Saul's against him is are rabble rousers. They're not good men, except for a couple. So even then, David sees God's faithfulness, caring for him. So what's happening there? Remember, we'll go back to our psychology talking about attachment, how important attachment is. God is giving him the secure attachment. Like, David, I'm with you. I am showing you that I love you. I'm being faithful to you. And yes, you're going through hard circumstances, but I'm paying attention because I am attached to you. And that gives David a secure place to remain where he's at, to be waiting for God to do what he needs to do, so that David actually comes from a secure place. We talk about this in attachment theory, that when children feel securely attached to their parents, it is then they're able to go out and be creative. They've seen that most people can be more creative when they actually have somewhere a secure base, that they know that they belong. And so that's what's happening with David this whole time. Yeah, hard stuff. But every time you see God being faithful to him. And so David's able to not only go through these hard circumstances, but able to remain firm in, no, God has called me, he has anointed me, I know that this is who I am, and I'm okay with waiting for whenever God brings that about. So it also enables him then to be exactly who he's meant to be, which is king, and it makes him able to fulfill the responsibilities of king. He understands that his role in part is to facilitate a secure place for his people. So God has made a secure place for him by saying, I am attached to you. I'm paying attention to you. And then David's job is to do that for the people of Israel. Mm. You have a secure place. You are attached to God because I'm attached to God. And I'm your king. And so in the ancient Near East, the king was the people. The people were the king. I mean, there it was hard to... I've lost the word. It was hard to tell one from the other. So that for David to remain secure with who he was in God, to know that God said, you belong, David. You belong in my family. You are my son. That helps David to make a secure place for his people. That's a responsibility of the king. So when we think about that, we need to also realize that God reveals himself as king not only through a father-son relationship in David and his descendants, but also through this earthly king, with David being king and fulfilling the responsibilities of king. So in the ancient Near East, again, the king was ruling in the stead of the gods, right? In the place of the gods. So we often, in theological terms, we actually call that a regency. So a regency is actually, do you know what a regent is?
Acting on behalf.
Someone who is actually acting as king on behalf of the real king, right? Usually a regency is because the king, let's say in England, is too young. So somebody stands in as king until he reaches the age that he can actually be king. So they happen in lots of the royal line in England and all over the place. Mm-hmm. That's what a regent is. And so David is considered a regent. Yes, he is the king of Israel, but he's actually a regent. He's standing in for God because God isn't here present completely on his throne. So David's there to do that.
Did David identify himself as that, like to the people? Did he say, I'm a regent?
So he wouldn't have used the term regent, but he would have absolutely understood that. And in fact, you'll see some of the language. He'll say, you know, I know that I'm... God is king. In fact, which is why, remember that all the Psalms are considered all sitting around the Davidic covenant. So the Psalms really talk about the Davidic covenant. And remember, we have the Psalms of David as king, but then we have the Psalms of, but God is actually the king. So that's the whole idea, is the Psalms really fleshes that out, that David is a regent. He is acting as a representative. And in that, it means that he was, one of his responsibilities was to embody the obedient listening son idea. Because the king and God is a father-son relationship, the number one responsibility for David was to embody that in his flesh, to actually show that he was a listening son. Do you remember what in Deuteronomy, God had already said, you're going to have a kingdom, you're going to have a king, and this is how the king should behave. Do you remember what the very first instruction that God gives kings? And this is something that the kings forget to do, and this is why when Josiah finds the word, he's like, oh, look at the word of God, it's been hidden all these years. The very first thing the king was supposed to do was to read the Torah every day. It was the king's responsibility to read the Torah every day because he was to embody a listening son. And remember, as a listening son, he represents Israel. He is Israel. So for us, that's a little odd thing because we live in a democracy. Mm-hmm. Like we can say, the president represents us, but he's not us, right? Like we don't like that idea at all. We're so individualistic. But in monarchies, what the king or queen does, that's what the nation does. And in some respects in the world, what our president does, that's what the U.S. does, right? And that's why we kind of go, oh, well, I don't like that.
But it really does happen.
It really does happen.
That's how people think about other countries.
Correct.
And how we think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yes. So again, that's David has to embody the listening son that Israel is supposed to be. So David is supposed to be doing that so that Israel knows what they're supposed to look like, and so the world sees Israel through the king's behavior. And his example as a listening son is supposed to shadow somewhat the right relationship. He's the son. He's not the father. He's the son, so he listens. He's the son, so it's the father's plans. It's the father's purposes, not his. So think about that. How do you think the rest of the world, the A&E, is going about doing kingship? They're supposed to do that too with their gods, but how does it really look?
Well, selfish, petty.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we've seen that all over. Yes, right, exactly. So because they live in a transactional world with their gods, they look very different. They just want to get what they want. This, the kingship in the Davidic covenant, is supposed to show a different way to live, right? And it is that receiving from the Father my role, my responsibilities, and then giving that out to the others. But that role and responsibility always is undergirded with God saying, you belong to me. And because you belong to me, you are able to give out. I think that's one of the things when we talk about that our lives are supposed to give out to others. I think sometimes we begin to think that is impossible because we don't remember, first of all, I can't do that unless I am very sure about my attachment with God, that God has given me. We'll talk even more about what that looks like in a couple of paragraphs to go. The second responsibility a king had was to demonstrate and represent God's justice. So we talked last week, what about justice? What about when things are wrong? Well, that was the other thing that the king was supposed to represent, was how does God show justice? How does God mete out justice? And so, and we will talk more about justice. And really, when we talk about justice, we're talking about social justice, about how one another, how the people in the kingdom relate to one another, right? Justice is always about how each other relates to one another. Sometimes we forget that that's what justice is, right? We think justice is getting my rights, when justice is actually that people are able to relate to one another in a right way. And that's what justice is. And that's the whole point that God, that David is supposed to be doing. He's supposed to be representing social justice. We see that, of course, in his son Solomon, right? I mean, we see how he metes out justice. He wants to make sure that people are working together. And so when he does the whole famous baby thing, we see him really giving to the women, how can you work this out together? And he's wise enough to give them an idea, right? By saying, well, we'll just cut the baby in half, knowing he's not going to cut the baby in half. I mean, that's kind of a picture of what God did with Isaac, right? He knows that. What he's doing is giving the women, how are we going to come together on this? Mm-hmm. Right? Because if he had a different plan, it would be one against the other. But this way, his plan is, how are you going to come together? How are you going to live together on this? So, the earthly king, as a steward, rules in God's stead, and he reflects the kind of rule that God has. We have to think about God as ruler all the way back to Genesis 1 and 2, right? And what was the purpose of his ruling? What was the purpose of his ordering life?
To give us names and...
Yeah, right? To help us flourish, right? It's to help others flourish. It wasn't so he had everything great. It was for others. His rule was always about ordering in such a way that humans could flourish as human beings in right relationship with God. So that... again, switches the paradigms of what a king is supposed to be, how he's supposed to rule, that he's supposed to rule not with forceful power, not saying you will do this, but giving, tending, naming worth, stewarding the earth, all of these things in order to make sacred space, in order to make a place where God and man could rightly relate with one another and they could rest, that whole idea of shalom and Sabbath. And in that, we're always talking still about father-son. In making a sacred space, he makes a space where others know they belong. And that's what a safe space is, right? A safe space is, I walk in and I know I belong here. That's why I asked that question of where, what age or what circumstance it was that you just felt you belong. And most of you, I would guess, like had a specific instance, right? I knew I belonged here. I will tell you that because I grew up in a non-Christian home but became a Christian at 10, I never felt like I belonged to my family, ever. I know this is really weird, but for 3 years, I prayed every night that I would die before I went into high school because I never felt like I belonged. And then I got into high school. Guess where I belonged? Because of race riots, my parents sent me to a Christian high school. And I like, oh my goodness, I actually belong here. And it just felt like those would probably be my favorite time that I can think back on is 4 years of being in a place where I knew I belonged. And that belonging really, like, I was super shy. I got in high school and all of a sudden, like, I was doing everything. I mean, it was phenomenal for me. But again, that's that idea of because I belong, because I know I belong, I now have the space to be free. That's what David is supposed to be doing as a king, tending and stewarding and making a safe space, a sacred space. Safe space is always sacred because a safe space means I belong. I know that God says I belong to him. And I have a loving father, and thus I can rightly relate to not only God, but now I can also rightly relate with others. And that makes a big difference, right? If I know I belong because God says I belong, I can also feel like I can belong with others as well. Because of secure attachment, I now have a little bit more confidence to go out and belong to others. But here's the thing about belonging to others, right? You hit up against, like, well, nobody's paying attention to me, or nobody sees me. Part of the idea of sacred space where we relate rightly is also us helping one another to know that we belong, right? So it's like, Diane, you come in and you say, oh, I love that you did this for us today. And it's like, oh. And in fact, the first thing we did when we went into groups, I was talking to this group here, and Edie said, oh, Jill, I'm so glad that you're doing this. She doesn't know that I'm struggling with doing this. And it's like God says, I'm reminding you, you belong, you belong. So sometimes we forget that that's part of our responsibilities, is that we talk to one another and we say, you belong here. Like, I see you. I know that you need to know that. Sometimes we don't know where people are coming from, but you can always assume it's your responsibility to say to someone, glad you're here. How are you doing today? I see you, right? Isn't that the best thing when somebody sees us? I don't, even if you're doing really well, I don't know about you, but I go home with words. For me, words are big. And if somebody has said something kind, like I can feed on that all day. That's part of what David is doing. He's making a space where he's saying that to the people so that the people are able to say that to one another. And that becomes a sacred space that, remember, all those people traveling through Israel, they look and go, look at that community. They love each other. And isn't that what the New Testament says? They'll know we are Christians by our love for one another. We're paying attention to one another. We're not walking around the world like everyone else is walking around the world, making sure that we get ours. We're actually walking around the world going, do you have yours? Do you feel loved? Do you feel seen? That's part of what David's responsibility as king is to make sure of that, is to be able to feed that to his people. So the responsibilities of kingship, when we think about being a king, because we live in a democracy, we think all of the power grabs, right? And the riches, right? I think for us, the first thing we think about are riches. But remember what he tells the Israel in Deuteronomy. He tells them, don't gather up lots of riches, because the riches I give you are for what purpose? It's for sharing. They're to give to others. So again, that's part of this making a sacred space where people feel they belong and they can rightly relate to God and rightly relate to one another. What that also means is the people in a safe space don't feel bad about asking for help. They don't feel bad about saying, I'm struggling today. Because they know that someone's going to say, oh, why are you struggling? And then being able to say, being able to share, right? And to be able to say, I want to come alongside of you, or whatever that might look like. So that there we start to see then that when David makes a sacred space, a safe space, because he belongs, gives that over, then we begin to see this perichoretic life going on in the community of Israel. And of course, that's what the church is supposed to look like, right? Yeah.
I'm just curious with the Israelites when they were in the wilderness. I feel like they were way more insecure. Was it because it's progressive? And like,
yes.
They weren't there yet. They didn't trust God yet.
Yep. Yeah. Remember, when they first came out to the desert, they had no idea there was any such thing as a transformational God. It was transactional. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's going to be, I want mine now, and you're going to give it to me, that kind of thing. But you see them progress as well. And you see, actually, even the heads of the covenant progress as well until we get to David. And when you talk about David in a Jewish community, that's like a big deal, right? Because they see David as pretty good. I mean, he really, again, had a heart after God's own heart, right? So, yes, we see that. And we see Israel as a nation becoming more and more like that. But of course, they're still corrupt underneath, right? Mm-hmm. They still can't get it quite.
He gets distracted.
Yes, absolutely.
And even though, like,
sounds familiar.
He's secure, yeah. We're not even, he's the one that's talking, right?
Right, exactly. So we see David, we also see David himself experiencing belonging within the community. Where does David experience belonging?
With the mighty men?
His crew.
Sometimes with his crew, right?
Jonathan,
exactly, right? Jonathan, several times he takes on, like he knows he's the anointed king, and yet he still is vulnerable, right? He knows he needs a friend, and Jonathan is there to say, oh no, you belong. I love you. Greater, and David later says of Jonathan, greater than the love of women is my love for Jonathan. This, like, that's, to me, that's a beautiful story. And I think that's why she pulls out Jonathan and David so often, is that's what it looks like to be in perichoretic union. This vulnerability to say, I need, like, I'm in trouble, you need to help. And Jonathan being able to help, and them to be able to say, you know, I love you this much. So the king needs to rule in God's stead. He needs to reflect God's kind of rule, not the power rule, but the rule where he's tending and naming worth. But he also needs to be committed to God's plan and purposes and not his own. And God's plan and purpose is, of course, to reveal himself as a benevolent, holy God, king, that actually compels people to come into a relationship with him. That's his plan and purpose. That's what David has to be committed to, not his own plan and purpose. And think about how difficult that would be. You've just been given the kingship over the nation of Israel, the place that's in the crossroads of all the country, of all of the world at that time. You've been given that position. It would be so easy to make plans for yourself, right? Like, well, I'm going to do this. And even couch it in, I'm going to do this for God, right? Mm-hmm. Make my own plans. And yet we see time after time with David is actually saying, well, here's my plans. And God says, no, that's not the plan. Oh, okay. And he steps back, right? So he abandons his own way of getting things done, accomplished, even though they're for God. Every time David, it's really fun to read David's story, because every time David goes into battle, he says, wow, it looks like I should be battling these people. But instead of making plans, what does he do? He always asks God, should I go into battle? Is this my fight? And God usually says, yes, this is your fight. This is where I want you to go. But he always does that first. And you'll see, I think it's 2 Samuel, maybe 5, where it's like 3 or 4 battles in a row. And you would think like he'd get on a roll and just, like, you know, I can just go because I'm pretty sure that's what God wants me to do. But every time he says, God, should I continue this battle? Should I do this? God says yes. And he goes and he listens to it. So he abandons his own ways. When he, of course, in that covenant time, when he decides that he wants to build a house for God, I mean, that's a good thing, right? He wants to make a beautiful, stable house for God, and he has the means to do it. And so he thinks he's going to do it, and Nathan says, yeah, go ahead, do it. And then, of course, Nathan hears from God and comes back and said, no, David, don't do this. Now, here's an interesting thing, that David is willing to listen to Nathan and not do that. Think about that. He has all these plans, and now Nathan says no. But who has more power? David has more power. And yet, David says, oh, okay, I'm not going to. And in fact, because in that time, God tells Nathan, tell David, I'm going to build him a house. I'm going to build him a family. And so anytime we talk about house in the scriptures, there's always this twofold. There's this physical place for your presence to be, but there's also the spiritual descendants of there's going to be, I'm going to build you a house as in family. Mm-hmm. So it's always a house meant to be filled with family. And so God says to David, no, I'm going to build you a house, and I will let your family that I'm building in you build me a house, so that we have this beautiful picture of this pericritic union here. And so David listens, which is the second point about David, is not only does he abandon his own ways of getting what he thinks needs to be accomplished, he also humbly receives God's defense and provision and timing, right? All those years that he was running from Saul, and he's anointed those whole time, and yet he doesn't grab the throne. We see that in all the stories of David, right? That David had a chance to kill Saul several times, but particularly in the cave. And he doesn't, because this is, right? This is not God's time. He's waiting. This is, God also anointed Saul. He's waiting for God to bring it about. And all of that, he understands, is God paying attention to him. We do the opposite, right? We say, my picture isn't happening. Things aren't going right. God, aren't you paying attention? Right? I mean, that's how I feel. There are lots of times I think, God, what are you doing? Don't you see what's going on here? I'm crying out to you, and you're not fixing this. David, remember again, is a type of Christ, and he is willing to wait. I know that God is doing what he needs to do, and I'm going to wait. Now, do you think David ever had times of going, I don't know what's going on here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course he did. Absolutely. But he is willing to wait, knowing he goes back to, oh, I belong to God. I'm his son. I'm listening. So I'm listening for him to bring it about.
Isn't that reflected in his Psalms?
It's reflected in his Psalms over and over again, right?
Not waiting like, doo-doo-doo-doo. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, right. He's calling out. He's crying, right? He cries out in anger. He cries out in desperation. And he does this over and over again. You see the honesty in David's Psalms, right? Mm-hmm. And that's this vulnerability to say, I know I belong to you, so I can come to you with anything, and I can just prostrate myself before you, and I know you're listening. The interesting thing is it's the prophetic office actually gets established through the Davidic covenant. And the reason it does is it is a balance, a check against absolute rule of David's ruling. It makes sure that David's rule is actually God's rule. Because the prophetic office is the person who actually brings words of God to the king to make sure. And we see this with Nathan, right? We see Nathan saying, no, this isn't God's plan. And we see Nathan convicting David, right, when he sins against Bathsheba and Uriah. We see this as the prophetic office gets established within the Davidic covenant, so that the ruling of the regent is making sure that it's not the regent who's ruling, but God who's ruling. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's God's words being showing him where to go and what to do. And again, all of these you should be thinking about. Since David is a type of Christ, is a picture of Christ, does that happen with Christ? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. And you have to begin thinking about all the times when Jesus was committed to God's plan and not his own. Mm-hmm. We even see it all the way into the garden, right? What does he say?
Not my will, but yours, right?
Mm-hmm. Like Jesus as a human being thought, you know, there could be a better plan. Yeah, but right, it's God's plans. He's committed to that, and he's willing to listen then to the prophetic voice through Nathan, but also through Samuel. Think about it. When Samuel was the first prophet, so it starts to ooze in right before the Davidic covenant is put in place. But Samuel comes to him as a teenager, and he says, "I'm going to anoint you king." Now, as much as a teenager would love to hear that, in those day and ages, wait, there's a king right now? Don't put me in that position, right? But he's willing to listen to Samuel. God has called you to be king. I'm anointing you, and you're just going to have to wait and listen for him. So again, we see David willing to listen. And particularly in the Gospel of John, you will see Jesus portrayed as a listening son, because he keeps saying, I only say what I hear the Father saying. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I ever talk about, is what the Father talks about. Mm-hmm. He's listening all the time. That's where David is supposed to be a type of Christ. We're looking now at a little bit more of a integrated relationship, father-son relationship here between the king and the regent. God being king then is revealed through a king whose heart is completely his, through a regent whose heart belongs to God, who has given up his own independent way of doing things. He's not that kind of powerful king that we think about. He is a king who's given up his own will, his own plans, his own purposes, his own ideas. He's given that up, death to independence, and he finds life in God's desires. He loves God's plans and God's purposes. And he finds that so much. There's a point where David says, I have zeal for your house, so much so that I've lost my brothers and my mother because I have such a zeal for your house. I have such a zeal for your kingdom expanding, for your house to be filled with children who rightly relate to you. That's my zeal. And of course, Jesus says that, right? Mm-hmm. He uses David's words to say, they say about Jesus, I have zeal for my Father's house. And we'll touch on that again. So what we need to look at as we look at the Davidic covenant is what a king really looks like that is a king of God's, that is a regent of God's. It's not the type of king we're thinking about. It's not this powerful, you will, as soon as I did that, I thought of the King of Siam, right? And that's kind of a picture of, that's how I'm supposed to be. And then he gets softened, right? And he realizes, no, a real king actually tends to others. A real king, boy, now I want to watch that movie. A real king actually looks out and pays attention.
The King and I.
Yul Brynner. So we have to think about that when we're thinking about the Davidic covenant, is this picture of Christ, his kingship. Because I think a lot of times when we get into the New Testament and we ask, well, is Jesus portrayed as king there? We think no, because we want to put on our idea. But God says, no, my idea of kingship is to name worth, is to tend, is to give and make space for people to feel like they belong. Man, Jesus did better than anybody else, right? Mm-hmm. To make people feel like they didn't belong. We're going to talk about that next week a lot. So that's as much as I want to touch on the Davidic covenant. I want to switch our gears a little bit, although it really goes into what does that look like for us? Let's think theologically about how it looks for us to die to our independent self. Remember that Christ is the regent, he's the king, but we're the people of Israel, we're the people of God, who are supposed to take that how Jesus belongs to God so much, the Father, and we belong to Jesus. But how does that look? How are we able to go from death to life? How is it that the death of us, of our independent identities, How does that bring life? So that's what we want to look at in a little bit more theological terms. So from death to life, what kind of life are we looking at? So first of all, we need to look at the life we left. And that was independent, right? An independent life, an autonomous life. But an independent, autonomous life means that we live alone. And we've talked about this so many times. I can't imagine nobody doesn't know that. But what is the most basic need of a human being?
Belong.
To belong, right? To belong. Over food, over water, belonging is the basic need of human being. And so independence means living alone. So every time I'm working toward independence, I'm working toward death, right? I'm working toward not being fulfilled, not being whole. There's nothing worse than isolation, right? There's nothing worse than that. And no matter how independent you are, no matter how introverted you are, no matter how much you think you can do things on your own, when you are alone and isolated, you feel not whole. You feel, I mean, you think about people who you think are just so confident in themselves. You don't think that they go home at night sometimes and think, oh, I'm alone? Yeah, they do. We do. We all have that. And we all go through times in our lives where we feel alone. Because I was the oldest of four girls, I was always tasked to babysit when my parents would go out. And I probably should have never had kids when I realized I was doing this. The way that I disciplined my sisters is, put them all in different rooms. Thinking that would stop the fighting, right? But what it really did is broke their spirits, right? Because isolation is never good. And it makes me cry to this day.
Cry because... You're probably 12. Like, give yourself...
I realize parents do it all the time, though. Time out is the big thing. It's to separate the child from the situation.
Yeah, exactly. But the funny thing is, we want to separate them from the situation, but we don't want to... We shouldn't be separating them from one another.
Right.
So that's one of those things. Anyway, that's how I used to discipline my sisters. I thought I was doing a really good job.
I think about the people in solitary confinement. This is one of the worst things that you can do to somebody.
Absolutely the worst. Absolutely the worst. I can remember doing it to my own kids. Now, the funny thing is, Christian was fine with it for a while. Lissa, oh my goodness. There would be more, I probably shouldn't say that. but there would be a lot more static if she was alone. That would be hard. But again, independence means living alone, and isolation is never a good thing. And that doesn't mean never being personally alone isn't a good thing. Sometimes that is. For introverts, we need alone time, but we don't need to be isolated. And that's probably the hardest thing for an introvert is to bring that forth. Like, I need alone time, but don't leave me alone. Don't think because I need alone time, you don't ever call or you don't ever interact with me. It's just an odd thing. Whereas extroverts, they don't ever get alone time, right? And they don't want alone time, maybe. But it's that independence. It's that not needing others that brings us that isolation. The constant striving, then, to be autonomous and independent, that's a disease. And that's what poisons our blood. So we're talking theological terms here. Thinking about, and this is how the Old Testament talks about sin, is a poison to the blood, that it is slowly killing us. It doesn't kill us immediately. It's slowly killing us. It's debilitating us, right? It's debilitating for us being whole. It's bringing us farther and farther away from being whole. Throughout history, men have always... I shouldn't use the word men. That's one thing I learned in graduate school. You can't ever use the word men anymore. Humanity understood that blood was actually the essence of life, right? If you don't have blood flowing through your veins, you're not alive. So blood is the essence. And they knew that because life is in the blood, if your blood was diseased, you needed to get that disease out of the blood, right? And so they would Yeah, drain the blood. They would let the blood out. Because, and in truth, that was actually pretty good practice. When you think about, I know that blood gives you life. You're sick. Your blood must be sick. Your blood must be diseased. And in theological terms, perfect. That's exactly what it is. Our blood is diseased. Our blood has this independent germ that's going throughout our bodies in the blood. And we to release that poison would be to let the blood flow out, which is why we have so many of those times when people put leeches on themselves and or on someone else so that the blood would come out. Because we all look out for self, because we all have that desire for independence and autonomy, we all have diseased blood, right? We all, and that's what Romans talks about, all have sinned. We all are diseased. We all have this autonomous desire to control our own lives and to make the decision about what's good and what's evil. And Hebrews 9 says, without the shedding of blood, getting rid of that independent life, there is no remittance of sin. You can't get rid of the poison in your blood unless you get rid of the blood. So, independence not only means living alone, but it also means dying alone. An isolation that is permanent. Now, I can't imagine anything worse. It's one thing to live alone, but to die alone, that it's... It used to be my my advice to Christian before he was married. You do not want to live alone. Because if you don't ever get married, you will die alone. Yeah, well. But if you die alone, that isolation is permanent, right? Mm-hmm. Dying of disease, dis-ease, means that you are not at ease, at rest with reality, right? With the reality of connecting with one another, of who God is and who you are in relationship with God. That's really what hell is. It is isolation from reality. It is isolation from right relationship. And it's being given what you've been striving for all your life. It doesn't mean you're not in the presence of God. It means you aren't, you don't see that you're in the presence of God. It means that you are completely isolated from the reality that God is everywhere. Romans 3:23 says, the wages of sin is death. So if that's the life we left, this aloneness, this life of isolation, the life we need is found in the blood, right? Life is found in the blood. And if that's true, then what we need is pure blood, clean blood. We need blood that doesn't have the same disease as us. I don't know how many of you have ever read Jodi Picoult. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she's a provocative writer. Mm-hmm. And years and years ago, she wrote a book called Sister's Keeper. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They made it into a movie. They changed the ending of the movie. Yeah. Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
But Sister's Keeper was about a family who had a child who they loved tremendously. But the child had leukemia, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. So, which is a blood disease. Mm-hmm. And they knew that the only way to save this child was to have a perfect match for her. A perfect match for her blood so that they could get rid of her diseased blood and put in real blood. And they couldn't find a match. But they did know how to genetically create a child. So they decide to genetically have a child that perfectly matches their child's mm-hmm. blood. The whole purpose is so that they could give life to their first child. Mm-hmm. So they had a child in order to give life to their other child. But we know somebody else who did that. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what God does. Mm-hmm. Right? He produces his son himself as flesh because he has the right match for us, right? He has the human blood, but it's not corrupted like ours. It doesn't have the same disease. We don't want the blood of someone who has the same disease. There isn't anyone on earth that could have given us their blood because they all are infected with this independence, this autonomy. And yet, God become flesh doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. He's got fresh blood. He's got clean and pure blood. So that God in the flesh becomes the perfect match, the perfect donor. Mm-hmm. So for the life of the flesh is in the blood, Leviticus says, and Hebrews says, therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify, make holy and pure the people through his own blood. So if Jesus is going to give us his blood, how do you get blood out of your system? You got to cut yourself, right? It's got to be cut. So there has to be a cut, which is why we talk about the cut of covenant. In order for us to have life, Jesus' blood, he needs to be cut. So when someone volunteers to give blood up for another, or someone volunteers to give up an organ for another, they actually have to sign a pledge, right, of giving their right up. It's not their blood any longer, right? When I go to the blood bank, I can't give blood, but when you go to the blood bank and give blood, you got to sign a waiver. Mm-hmm. It's no longer your blood. Mm-hmm. It is goes to another person, and it becomes their blood. So that you're giving up your right to that life, and you're giving it to another. Oftentimes in the Old Testament, they would make that kind of a pledge with a hand gesture. And the hand gesture, how many, which one? No, Shazak. Yeah. So Shazak is this. And that is a couple things. So Shazak is used in Joshua and in most of the Old Testament for God saying, I have Shazaked you. I have put my arm on yours. So that kind of a grasp, first of all, is a stronger grasp than this or this or this. This is the strongest grasp. If you're a mountain climber, you know that, right? That you, this is how you have to hold on. That's Shazak. That's the Old Testament idea of, I'm giving you my strong arm as a pledge that I'm not going to let you go. God says that to Joshua. God says that to Moses. In the New Testament, the word is taka, and it means to strike or clasp hands together as if a nail is being driven in them, which is exactly what happens to Jesus, right? And it's that word that's used, that that taka. Jesus strikes his hand on the cross. Sometimes we use a gesture if we put our hand over our heart, right? I swear to you. I'm pledging to you. But when somebody gives their blood or gives an organ to somebody, there's not just this responsibility of I've given you this and it's yours now, but there also becomes this spiritual bond. I don't know how many of you have known people who've had an organ from someone. I actually have a friend who actually did get blood from someone else. She got a bone marrow transplant, which is the manufacturing of the blood, and she had leukemia. And it's so interesting. She got her blood donor. Her donor was a stranger. It was a man. And the relationship they have is amazing. Like, I'm always like, wow, it's so cool. He lives in California. She lives here. And they sometimes vacation together. They are always in connection with one another. They live vastly different lifestyles. And yet there's this spiritual connection. Like, you have my life in you, and you've given me your life. There's this bond that happens because of being given someone else's blood, someone else's life. So physically and spiritually, those kinds of, and emotionally perhaps, those kinds of things happen. And it's this idea of I'm never, like, she would never forget her donor. She would never forget who he is and, like, what his life is about. And he, with the same with her, which is a pretty amazing thing to watch, that bond of sharing. God says the same thing about us. In Isaiah 49, he says, I will not forget you because I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands. It's a really beautiful idea of that. So, there's been the cut, there's been an agreement, there's been a cut, and now there has to be the transfusion, right? There has to be this commingling of blood, this idea of I'm giving yours and you're giving yours out. I have to let go of my blood, die to myself in order to join with his life. This is the idea of blood brothers. How many of you as kids became blood brothers? Yeah, I knew you would, Lisa. Most of us were tomboys, right? Like, yeah, we did that. Most of the girly girls. And if you were cheerleaders, you probably didn't do that. All messy. And I actually thought, literally, I thought, We should do that.
I totally thought that last time. I know. Tomorrow, what's she going to do?
And I thought about that, and I thought about how we could do it, and then I thought, well, we've got a couple of nurses in here, so this is Janie. They probably go, oh, no, we don't share blood. So I thought about cutting everybody and then mixing, yeah. And then I thought, oh, I guess I can't really do that.
I used to blood type my kids in school.
Oh, yeah, but you could never do that now.
And I thought, you could never do that.
No.
But we used to do that just, so they could find out what
Right. But so the commingling of blood was always you cut yourself, they cut theirself, and then you press it together, right? We do it on the fingers, but they would do it here. This is where they would do it. So it was always here, somewhere around here. You would mix the blood. I think in Princess Bride, don't they do that?
I know Outlander, they did
it. Oh, in Outlander, they do it, yeah. So lots of different places that show, times back.
But he just doesn't eat blood. I'll do it, Jesus.
Yes, exactly. So again, I've been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. Now think about those verses and how what those mean about him giving us his life. If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So there was a transfusion, but then there was actually the drinking of blood. In pagan cultures, they would drink the blood. Of course, in Jewish cultures, they would not drink the blood. Mm-hmm. And why would they? Remember, Jesus or God says to them, do not drink the blood. Now, he has to tell them that because it is a custom elsewhere, right? Don't drink the blood. But why does he say that? It's unclean, right? Even animals have been contaminated with the independence of man. Because man is regent over the animals, even animals' blood is contaminated with our autonomy, with our ideas of independence and going our own ways.
It's not because it's really dirty. It's because it's symbolically dirty.
Correct. Because it has this independent idea. Janie, did you want to say something?
No, I'm trying to myself. Have blood in animals.
But Jill, if you do swallow enough blood, you will throw up.
Yes.
So it's
even your own.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So it's not meant to
be. Right, exactly. And of course, and all of our blood is, I mean, there are things in it that are, not great. And yet there is one blood that is pure, right? One blood that is clean. So one of the reasons that God makes this is not only is it supposed to be contaminated by us, even the animal's blood, he wants it to be, when he gets to Jesus, oh, there's a blood that's not contaminated. Drink this. And so it's meant to be this shock to the Jews. When Jesus says, drink my blood, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, think about what the Jews do at that time. That actually is, it says, the very next verse says, anybody know what the very next verse says after it? And then many disciples left him. Because they're Jews, they're good Jews. Like, we're not eating you, we're not drinking your blood. And of course, Jesus is trying to show them, no, there's actually one flesh and one blood that actually is nourishing for you. And that is mine, because it is pure. It isn't been contaminated. It is a pure listening son who is completely in right relationship with the Father. Unless you eat the flesh and drink the blood, you have no life in yourself. Because what looks like life to us is really death. We are all decaying, right? All of our life is decaying. But we must take in non-decaying life. So we have commingling of the blood. We have drinking of the blood. These are all practices of covenant. And then the sealing of the cut, a permanent scar. So lots of times people want to permanently make a scar. Now, most of us, because we live in vanity heaven here, we don't want to make a scar except for one place. Do you know how we do that? Do you know that we actually do this all the time? Maybe not some of us, but
the tetanus shot. No, that's not it.
How do we make a scar permanent?
Is it the belly button?
Tattooing.
Mm-hmm. We make a scar permanent by burning it. And that's what tattooing is, right? It's actually putting a hole and then burning it. Right? That's what it is. I just went to I tried to find something to do with my daughter-in-law, and I everything's closed. So I found one art, she's a photographer, so I found one art exhibit at North Central College. tattoo artists. Okay, we're going there. So that was kind of interesting. But I thought about the fact that tattoos are actually a sealing of a cut. Mm-hmm. They're a sealing of a cut into your skin to make it permanent, right? And cuts of covenant were meant to be permanent, and they would actually seal them by burning them, by cauterizing them, right? To make them not for, to make all those white blood cells not come together and make skin again. So that it was a permanent reminder of a shared life. Because when they made a covenant cut, remember, it was your life and my life. It's one. This is all about our life being one. And we want to remember that. We want to share that.
I totally think of a belly button now. Like, that's a remnant of a shared life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, good. Very good.
That's what I thought you were talking about.
That's really good. Yes. No. That's good. Mm-hmm. And I like that because we tie it into a knot.
Long time ago, everybody had to get vaccinations before you could go to school. And some of them had big scars here.
That's what she
was
talking about.
And some of them have scars here, like me. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of that.
But that, we didn't purposely want to make a scar there. It wasn't for us to remember anything, but it just did. Yeah,
it was
right.
Purpose
right.
to tell
right, exactly.
others.
Right, yeah.
That we were safe.
Yeah. Right. Exactly, exactly.
Safe for them.
That's true. Even... How many of you have a scar somewhere?
Oh,
no. When you touch that scar, does it bring back a little bit of a memory to you?
The fresher it is, the more it hurts too. So it like
triggers. Oh, right, right. I have a C-section scar, and that like I touch that, and it's like it goes right back.
Yeah.
Like even thinking about touching it goes right back to like what all that was about. So that not just seeing it sometimes, but touching it. And, of course, we have Thomas, right, who says, I'm not going to believe him unless I see the scars. And Jesus says, all right, Thomas, you see him, but I want you to touch him now. I want you to know that this is what I've done, that this is my covenant cut for you so that you can share my life. Revelation also talks about the fact that the one who is worthy to open the books of the end of life is the one who has been slain but is now alive again. So Revelation talks about the fact that how do we know that he's been slain but is now alive again? Because we're able to see his scars. We'll be able to see the cuts that were there. And there's several places where Revelation talks about the Lamb of God as if one slain because we can see his scars. Zechariah says, and he... Zechariah basically is a prophet who tells the Jews, you will recognize the one who actually makes this covenant fulfilled by his scars. Genesis 12, or Zechariah 12 says, you'll look on me whom they have pierced, and you will mourn. But Zechariah 13:6, I love that one. And one will say to him, what are these wounds between your arms? Then he will say, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. Mm-hmm. And that's how Israel will recognize Christ when he returns, is being able to see his scars. Because they'll know those are covenant scars. They'll know that he was the one who actually gave life to give life, that he was the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. So I think it'll be interesting to see as we watch Israel. So Israel has become, right now, modern day, more and more secular, right? And we see that. There's a lot of people calling for Israel to, and a lot of Christians calling for Israel to say, you've got to get back to being a religious place, a place of God, so that you remember that you have a covenant with God, and that God is going to show you these covenant scars. So I know it will happen because this is how they will recognize him. So the life we needed... the life we gave up, and now the life we receive. Interdependent life means never alone again. It means that my belonging need is met. This is weird. As soon as I said that, I thought, never alone again? As an introvert, whoa, that's hard. But never, ever feeling not like I belong again. Always feeling like I belong. Always knowing I belong. And if I know I belong, then I have the freedom to move about life with confidence, right? With confidence that I'm securely attached. Think about a toddler walking away from his mother. What happens to that toddler if you watch it long enough?
Turn around.
He turns around, right? His mom is still back there? His mom's still back there? Yeah, yeah, he's still back there. I was with Susan Dahl, who, remember, lost her husband. Really had a really fun time with her kids. And she told me about Caleb. It's been a month since their dad died. And, of course, there's all sorts of ways that comes out. And one day he decided he was going to run away. And so she said, okay, you know, what are you going to do? And so she let him go. You know, she stood outside the front door, and she watched him. And, you know, about every 10 steps, kind of back, like, you know, just kind of back. And she said, you know, she in her mind thought, I'll let him go that far and right. I won't farther. And he never got to that point because, you know, he stood and he went back, and finally he just comes running back to the mom. I mean, beautiful picture, though, of this idea of the secure attachment, right? He needed to know that he had a mom, that somebody was there for him, that he still belonged, even though dad wasn't there.
How old is he?
7. Which is the very first time that you actually can understand death. Yeah. So it's this is a struggle that he needs to have that Lucy, the daughter, wouldn't have yet. Mm. So this idea of knowing I belong gives me the freedom to be able to walk out. Now, that doesn't mean that I walk out and I never have to look back again. It means that I'm always looking back, that there are times in my life where I forget I even belong because it feels like I don't right now, and I need to turn back. Do I belong? And that's where we come in again, right? Who's there to see me turning back? Who's there to see me looking like, do I belong? Like, if I look back and no one's there, then I probably walk a little further, right? At some point, we have to enter into that idea of seeing if people are looking back. But it also then gives me the creativity to fulfill my purpose of being a treasured people, right? Somebody in a partner in God's plan. And in that, knowing that I have a unique place in that, right? It's my way of fulfilling God's plan, of being a partner in God's plan, is going to look different than Cindy's and in Laura Jean's, right? Like I said, being in Laura Jean's youth group, sitting there the way she does a youth group, I'm sitting there going, oh my goodness, I could never do that. And I'm not supposed to do that. It's not like, oh, I want to be able to do that. It's like, wow, I love that God brings us uniquely. Mm-hmm. But both of us are doing the same thing in different ways, right, according to who God has made us, which I really do want to explore more as we go. So an interdependent life is a shared life. It means that we share and we meet needs so that we know that we're sharing our needs with God and that he's meeting our needs. But when he meets our needs, it's going to be through the body, right? Sometimes it's going to be miraculous. Sometimes it's going to be through... So here was a need that got met. When I spoke Sunday night at Laura Jean's church, I talked a long time in the parking lot, and then I was the last one to leave. So Judd went in his car, he drove off, and I went to go in my car, and my clicker wouldn't click. Oh. And I'm like, come on, it's not clicking. Okay, so I have to take the key out, and I put it in there. I get in the car, close the door, and now I drop the key. Pitch dark, I'm the only one there, and I can't find that key anywhere. And, of course, I don't ever use it like it. And I'm trying to think, how do I do this? How do I use I don't know which side to put it. I mean, it was one of these. So I was there a long time. I dropped it twice. And I finally got it in, and I put it in the wrong way once, and it pops out, and I put it in the other way. Okay, I finally get going. And all of a sudden, I noticed there was a car that came by, and it was waiting for me that whole time, waiting to see. I have no idea who it was. I don't know if it was Judd that came back. I have no idea. But I felt like God said, I'm watching you. I'm watching you. I'm making sure that someone in the body is watching you. And I have no idea who it was, but it felt like, wow, that was so cool. Because I was a little bit nervous, thinking, I don't know how to do this.
Jill, yeah, could have been a community radio watch person.
Well,
it doesn't matter.
The three of us are parked in the back, and so we're cleaning up. So, like, it could have been Ryan.
It could have been Elizabeth. Right, right.
Or it could have been Johnny. Or
or Johnny
who locks up the whole
place. Oh, okay, so maybe, yeah. So I have no idea, but he waited until I left, and I thought, oh, that was so nice. Yeah. Again, the body, right, looking after, meeting our needs. God is going to do that. God will supply all our needs according to his riches, what he has to give us, and he has everything to give us, right? 2 Corinthians says he gives, our giving is required to meet needs of others, not to make sure that we have little and somebody else has more. It's to meet the needs of others. That's what we do in the body. And remember that when it says that God will meet all my needs, again, pull back. Think about what that says. Meeting my needs to be an image bearer, to be a treasured possession. So not meeting my needs so that I have a really fun car to drive. Not meeting my needs so that I have chocolate to eat every day. Right? It's meeting my needs so that I can be an image bearer, a treasure possession, a holy people. And then today, as we talk about kingship, to be a royal priesthood. We'll talk about that tomorrow, next week. So that when I know God will meet my needs, then my responsibility is to share my needs, right, with God. I loved, Lord Jean, when we were praying all in a circle on Sunday night, you were so cute. All of a sudden she says, oh, wait a second. I've got to ask God to help us. Help us, God. Help us, God. That's it, right? We forget sometimes, right? To just cry out to him. But the thing that we forget even more, and I don't think we forget, we don't like, is we cry out to others, right? I need help. I'm struggling.
Cry out to others.
So that we ask others to help us as well. That's part of our responsibility of being under a regent who is ruling us, is to cry out for our needs. And we cry out to the body for our needs. The second thing that a shared life looks like is that there's the giving of names, identifying with one another. We see in Genesis 17 that God gives Abram and Sarai new names, Abraham and Sarah, indicating they have a new role, a new status. They are now prince and princess of great nations to come. Revelation 2:17 says that the overcomers, those who are victorious through his strength, and when we talk about strength, he talks about the right arm of his strength. His strength is when he lets out his life. So that's his strength. When we depend on that, we will be given a new name written on a white stone. Now, I love this, because what that is, their judicial system, when they would come before a judge, when they would decide on things, whether you were guilty or innocent, the way they did it was not pronounce it. They would give you a stone. And they would either give you a white stone or a black stone. Black stone, you're guilty. A white stone, you're innocent. So that's what it's talking about here, is you will have a white stone with a new name put on it. And that is that you belong. That you belong to God. You're innocent. You don't have disease of blood anymore. You have Jesus' blood. So you belong in him. So one of the things, instead of sharing blood, I thought we would do is share white stones. So what I want you to do is I want you to, actually I'll put this, take a marker and a white stone. And on the white stone, write belonging to God. So just like some of you have little labels that say belongs to, when you were a kid, like, belongs to your little. And that would be a good idea because you guys leave stuff here all the time. I know how it is. So go ahead and do that. Now, there aren't enough markers, so as soon as you're done with your marker, pass it off to the next person. And just write belonging to God on that. I want us to be able to, so many times when we learn about what God is doing and how he's working in covenant, we forget that. And we just need to be reminded daily, right? Mm-hmm. Minute by minute. So I think it's nice to always carry something around with us. I hope the rest aren't too big. I want us to carry around a reminder of, I belong to God. I have this confidence of secure attachment so that I'm able to go out and able to look and see where other people need to know, be reminded that they belong to God, but that I can also be confident in doing what God has called me to do. So keep them out for just a second. Don't put them away.
So, Joe, I
saw something last week that was about naming, and I wish I would have screenshot it because I thought, I got to send this to Jill, but it took me a while because I thought about it, and I was like, yes, this kid gets it. So it was a tweet by one of the students at the Parkland, Florida High School. And she was talking about, she was a senior, she goes, every morning when I drove into the senior lot, I saw Coach, I guess it was Coach Feist, who was one of the coaches that was killed. She goes, and I would wave at him, so he must have been on duty or something. She goes, I would wave at him, but I never knew his name until he was killed.
Oh.
She said, so today after I parked, I went and I talked to the crossing guard and I asked her name.
Oh,
that's
so good.
And I thought, you get it.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Get it. You get, you
yes.
see what's
yes, exactly.
And then I couldn't find it.
That's perfect.
And it took, you would think I would screenshot it right then, but then I had to mull it over, and I was like, yeah. And then I was like, why didn't I send that to Joe?
No, that's great. I'm glad that you told us all, because that's a beautiful picture of, yeah, that's where we're going to, right? When you have, does everybody have a stone? No. Markers. I actually, now that I think about it,
there's one in there. Did you have a
lot? No, but I actually have, somebody actually had one car on me.
That's a sample.
Was it red ink?
Oh, yeah.
It's in there. It's in there.
There's
it's
one
in there.
Yeah.
This one is actually like engraved.
Oh, engraved. Oh.
Is it in your?
No one's really big though.
What are you?
Plant. Sorry, guys.
Maybe not. Oh, no.
How big is it?
It's about this big, but it's really pretty. It's a white stone, and it's engraved. It actually engraved with Eden on it.
It's engraved
with Eden.
Oh.
You know what? Let me try that one.
This is better.
Well, that kind of disturbed me.
I wonder where that is.
All right. Everybody have this? I want you to turn to the person on your right. And I want you to give him your stone and say, give her your stone. Give you Mandy. Give her your stone and say, you belong to God.
You belong to God.
Oh,
right?
Oh, okay. Oh, I forgot.
You belong to God. So that's
still true.
Mine was somewhere in there. You're in there.
So do you have one?
Or yeah, you guys all went to the right
one. We went to the right. So did you get one?
Nope.
So she needs
that's
one.
That's a
spot. You belong to God.
So what I'd like you to do is just for a week or two, keep it in your pocket, the pocket that you're most using. You're going to be using it in your jacket for another week at least. So keep it in your pocket and just finger it every once in a while. Finger it when those times are that you're feeling like things are in life are just hard. That you might remember that God has said to Jesus, you and I are one. And Jesus has said to you, you and I are one. We share life together. You share my life. You belong. You can be confident that you belong. And you can actually go out in this world and face some of the hard stuff that you're facing. Or if you're not facing hard stuff, you can go out in the world and make sure that others know that they belong. So that we share one another's needs. We share our name with one another. It's why, depending on the culture, when you get married, it's a covenant. Somebody takes the other's name, right? And we have different ways of doing that. Sometimes there's this hyphenated. And I used to like not like that. But the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, but then they're both sharing this kind of name, right? They both have this. But this is the reason is why mostly women change their names is we're one. We're not two. We're not... And this is, I tell my kids this all the time, you are not two people living in a house together. Mm-hmm. You are one person sharing one life. And if you don't remember that, you will go apart. You've got to remember you're sharing a life together, which means you do share all of your needs with one another. You do share all sorts of things. Does it mean that my spouse is going to meet all my needs? Absolutely not. But you are one life. And you do, that's where the principal needs get met. That's where you identify with. When you walk out the house, you walk out with the identity of your spouse if you're married. And what you do with your life reflects on your spouse's life as well, and vice versa.
I have a great example that I'm on a team right now that what we talk about has to be kept confidential except with our spouses because we are one.
Exactly.
And I had never thought about it like that. I can't keep that from my spouse.
Right, exactly.
I am one and it's a big part of my life.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It always makes me a little bit nervous when women will say, oh, I don't tell my husband about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, you know, it can be funny and then you go, that's actually not what covenant looks like, right? And when that happens, I do think that there then lies this a little bit of a place that they're not being able to share.
Being able to and choosing to, they're a little bit different. They're like having the freedom to share, but
oh sure,
you know, it's not something that's going to matter to them.
Right, so right, know. Right, exactly. We're not going to share, like, you know what I ate today for lunch? I mean, we're not Facebook friends where I have to share what I've eaten today.
Like, if you normally wouldn't talk about a person in your life, you wouldn't automatically now.
Right.
Now I'm going to tell you.
Right, right. So remember that God has given us his name. We are called Christian, right? We're walking around with his name. And he's going to give me this new name that on this white stone that says, I'm actually him. I am Jesus, this eternal name. A question, though, becomes, do I identify myself as that? When somebody asks you, who are you? Tell me about yourself. Is the first thing out of your mouth,
I'm Jesus. I'm an image bearer.
Do you say, I'm an image bearer? I am a Christian. I follow Jesus. I've given my life to Jesus. Do you say that? Is that the first thing you say? And that is kind of like, think about if someone asks you, you know, tell me about yourself, and you don't mention that you're married until like way down the line, and your spouse is sitting there. How do they feel? Like, I read the obits. That's one of my, okay. And I read the obits because I used to write them when I was a newspaper editor. So I read them all the time, and I'm always curious as to how people mention their spouses and their families and where they mention it. And I've read a couple where they go down and down and down and down, and you think, was this person married or not? You have no idea until it gets to the end, and I think, oh, that's really weird.
But a lot of times it's written by the spouse, so it's an interesting view of what they felt about themselves.
That's true. Yes, exactly. Yeah,
I've read a lot lately. I do that too. and they talk about who survived them or who's gone before them.
Mm-hmm.
Huge paragraphs before they get to
who they really were,
married to so-and-so.
It's interesting. Particularly because when you write an obit, you're actually given a form that has those things.
It's
a
formula.
At some point, like, what's that person trying to tell the readers? Okay, my husband was a doctor, a physician. He did this is what he was. Yeah. Or if you listen to ancestors first, are you identifying with family first?
Right, exactly.
So I don't... Yeah. I'm just asking the question.
But I think that's one of those places where it's obvious of like what was most important, what was forefront, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things with our names. Do I consider myself an image bearer first, and then whatever I am, then a teacher, then that, so that whatever's first informs all the rest, right? Mm-hmm. When I consider myself first a teacher, that's a problem. Because then I'm teaching from here, and oh, image bearing. Oh, yeah, that comes in. But if I'm an image bearer first, then my teaching is influenced by the image bearing instead of the other way around. Does that make sense? I've often thought about how can I come up with a way to always identify myself as an image bearer first? First with myself, right? I'm an image bearer. I'm an image bearer. Because I think a lot of times when we get to a place where we're not feeling confident or we're not feeling good about ourselves, I think a lot of times we're thinking that we're something else beside an image bearer.
Yeah. You won't be hired as a teacher now if you say
that. That's true.
That's true.
They will not hire people that are Christians.
That's interesting.
They're unfit to be in that position.
Because we might share Jesus.
Well, and that's a good thing, because one of the next things we talk about is... Oh, we have 15 minutes. We'll get there. We talk about the marks of someone in covenant relationship. And sometimes those marks say, you've been in battle, right? You don't have something because you are in covenant. So another thing that a shared life looks like is that they share meals together. You partake of one another's lives. Sharing meals is one of those, from ancient times, sharing meals is very intimate. Mm-hmm. It does declare we are sharing life together. And sometimes I find it, I don't remember who I had talked to. Some old friends. And they said they never eat dinner together. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, that's weird. Mm-hmm. That just feels so strange. Mm-hmm. That time of intimacy, even though it doesn't seem, when we think about intimacy, it doesn't seem like it. It is an idea of sharing our lives together. Of course, we have lots of references. We have Isaac and Abimelech in Genesis that share a covenant meal. We have Moses and the leaders sharing a covenant meal. And, of course, Jesus sharing a covenant meal. So when I go to communion, when I go to the Lord's Supper and Eucharist, do I meet him at a covenant meal? Am I meeting him at a covenant meal, or am I doing a ritual? Am I meeting him, and do I come prepared to say, oh, I'm actually taking in your life again, again, and again? You haven't given your life over and over. You've given your life one time, but it's reminding me. I'm taking in your life. Oh, your life is in me. Your blood is in me. Do I think about that when I take communion? Sharing friendship is another thing that a shared life looks like. The word is ahav. That's affection. But it means more than that. It means coming from the heart. To have common interests and purposes and goals. So it's more than it's a two-sided thing. This ahav is a two-sided thing. It's this affection. I love that I get to do this, but I share purposes and goals. I share the same interests and the purposes and goals. We're all going to the same thing. That's how you make friends, right? It's not that you have everything in common, but it's like you have the same outlook. Like, oh, we both want to get here. We both have these same purposes of getting here. Psalm 25 says, God makes known his secrets to those in covenants, and a friend shares secrets. John 15, greater love is no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends, and I have called you friends. Mm-hmm. Again, when we build the covenant thing, we see Abraham being called friend, but not all of Israel. We see Moses being called friend, different term, but not all of Israel. And it's not till we get all the way into the New Testament and the New Covenant that Jesus calls all of us friends, that the people are all called friends together. So we see this burgeoning of this more intimate relationship. Proverbs 18 talks about a friend. There's a friend that sticks closer than a brother. How many of you have a friend that sticks closer than a brother? Yeah, that's the person you call when you're in big trouble, right? Like, it was probably the person you called when you got into jail, when you got arrested. I have to tell Cindy and Janet.
We know.
You know that? So Janet came to night class, and Cindy came to the morning class, and I was with Cindy and with Janet both, and Cindy said, well, I would call Janet LaRock. And, okay, that's nice. So at night, without Janet knowing, Janet said, well, I'd call Cindy. And I thought, that's really good. I love that. That you would call one another.
What's funny is we both were teetering on similar things. You were talking about your neighbor, the policeman.
Yeah.
The neighbor who's been just was
neighbor
the attorney
or something. Yeah, neighbor who has a son who's an attorney.
Yeah.
You were expecting to get in big trouble.
Yeah. I'm a guilty. That's why I was calling it.
So if God calls me friend, he wants to be in my company, right? Mm. Do you ever come where somebody's, where you don't realize they're going to say this, and someone says, oh, this is my best friend, or this is my good friend, and you don't know that? Mm-hmm. What does it do to you?
Mm-hmm. I'm put down.
You're put down?
I'm not the best friend.
No, when they do say that. When they say, when they introduce you as, this is my best friend.
They have a closer relationship than you think. Than you're thinking.
Right. Yeah, but doesn't it, aren't you honored?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like, oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah. To call you a friend. Instead of calling you an acquaintance, this is someone I know, this is someone who lives in my neighborhood.
Yeah,
but when they call you friend, they just said, you are important to me. Yeah, it absolutely names worth, yes. And God does that.
That I've been telling you about.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Well, then you're a little nervous.
They're not making the jail thing.
Yes.
Somebody's calling.
No, you know, it's these robocalls.
Oh, I know.
So, the idea of friendship, this ahav, brings us all the way back then to David and the Davidic covenant. Because that ahav, that from the heart idea of having the same purposes, that was David. That's why David was called a man after God's own heart. Because he felt ahav for Yahweh. He was absolutely wanting the same, he had the same interest, the same purpose, the same goals. This was the idea of that he has zeal for his father's house, that he wanted to build God's house so that God's family would grow, that there would be a sacred place for Israel to come and have right relationship with him and right relationship with one another. And making such a space meant he wanted people to know they belonged, just like he knew he belonged with God. And the fact that he allows God to say, no, you're not going to build it, but I'm going to have your son build it. That was actually an honor for him, to have his son build it. It led David then to make the preparations for it so that his son is able to build it. So David does several things to make the temple possible. Of course, he gathers material. But number one, he orders the priests. Up until that time, the priests kind of knew what they were doing in the tabernacle, but for the temple, they didn't have lots of jobs. There were lots of Levites. And so David was the one who actually ordered the priesthood, and he gave them individual jobs. This family will do this, and this family will do this, and you'll see that apportioned out in 2 Samuel, I think. So he assigned priests particular jobs, and then he wrote psalms for the liturgy, right? So everything that David did is he began to order everything so that when Solomon built the temple, things were in order and it could flourish. And so we begin to see this picture again. See, it gives me the goosebumps to think, oh, what he was doing, Genesis. Yeah, he was exactly again bringing in this idea of recreation. It all spoke to that, of making a sacred space for all to come. And so when we see then Jesus doing that, when we have the same words that Jesus had zeal for his father's house, when was it that it was talked about Jesus having zeal for his father's house?
When he cleansed
the temple, right? And so, of course, cleansing the temple, we know that he was trying to get out the transactions. But that wasn't the big deal. The big deal was he was cleaning out the courts. And the courts were the place where the women and the Gentiles could worship. It was the sacred space where women and Gentiles could come and have right relationship with God. That's what Jesus was doing, clearing out sacred space so all could come to be able to have right relationship as children who belonged. See, when they took over the courts, it meant that the Gentiles and the women couldn't feel like they were belonged, that they belonged. There was no space for them. Literally and physically no space for them. In fact, it's interesting when you look at some of the history about the temple is originally there was a short wall between the courts, and the walls grew. And there's signs. No women past this point. First of all, it says no Gentiles past this point, and then no women past that point. So there were all these walls. But Jesus is like, no, there's going to be space for everybody to be able to come. So an interdependent life remembers also the shared death, remembering the experience and accountability. So when I come to baptism, no matter if you do it as an infant or as an adult, those who view the baptism, I don't know how your church does it, but our church, we are all involved in that. We all have to say and make promises that we will bring, that we will be part of the body of Christ that reminds them of their baptism, that they belong, and that they have responsibilities as belonging. But also then, if I know you were at my baptism, then every time I see you, like, well, they know mm-hmm. that I belong. Mm-hmm. And so it's this accountability, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I breathe in. Same thing happens with communion. We take it together. You're never supposed to take communion by yourself. It's a communal activity to remember again that you have taken on God's life and you've made a pledge with him that you're taking on his life, that you're continually taking in his life, and that you're letting your blood go. And so we do that together publicly, continually reminding ourselves, first of all, how it is to have a life of isolation and then to have a life that's shared with all of us. It's one year I did a study with a pastor who was writing his doctorate, and we did a study of worship space. And the more we studied scripture and the more we went to spaces, we recognized that really because of that, sacred space today should be more round. We should be looking at one another mm-hmm. because that's where we're reminded. You, Diane, remind me that I belong, and I remind you that you belong, and that we all look differently, but that we're all one body. So that's part of being able to remind one another as we take communion with one another. And so for me, even ours is just like, probably a lot of ours is just like half, right? Yeah. I try very hard to be aware, like, this is all me. Like, we're all in this together, not me by myself, which I think is often kind of where we want to be, right? Mm-hmm. I just want to be me and God. And then I recognize, oh no, this is the body I'm with.
When you think about the old cathedrals, everything had the middle aisle and the,
Right. And there was actually walls, right?
Yeah.
There's actually walls between there, which is what our churches are mimicked against. Actually, ours are, we've actually taken ours up from the concert venues, unfortunately.
Yeah. Theaters.
Yeah. So I love it. There is a Catholic church in Naperville. St. Raphael.
Yeah.
It's a whole circle. It is the coolest thing. Now, as a preacher, that'd be tough.
Yeah.
You know, you're walking around. Mars Hill in Michigan is like that, too. So when Rob Bell would preach, he would, you know, he's going all over the place, which is fine for him. Most preachers can't do that. But I love that idea because then there's not this focus on either, depending on how the church is met, either the band or the preacher in liturgical, the table. The table is seen, but then all of the faces of Jesus are seen.
I remember going into a church in Charleston, and I don't even remember what denomination it was. It was on a tour, and there were family boxes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And that, oh, my God.
Right, exactly.
And there were walls.
And there were walls,
Doors on
walls.
Them.
And doors,
you don't see any. There were doors.
That's
you
right.
You don't see anybody but your family.
That's right, yeah.
And that the pastor was way up high.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, kind of crazy.
I'm convicted, like, when we do our opening song, like, I want to close my eyes. Mm-hmm. Just because you, like, you don't want to, like,
be distracted.
Creepy, like looking at other people. I'm like, oh no, we need to be looking at each
other.
Yes, yes.
I'm like, it's more comfortable for me.
Right.
If I close my eyes.
Right.
Like, no, look at people. I mean,
most people close their eyes because I've been looking at people.
Yes.
No, I did it on purpose because we're sitting and looking at each other, and it's kind of actually cool because some people when they sing, their whole face changes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so I kind of. Like when
but the voices are together.
Yeah, right. But there is something about looking at somebody and smiling, and even saying like this, like just looking at you guys mm-hmm. and being able to see people is helpful.
Yeah. But we, of course, we have to get comfortable with that, right? Mm-hmm. That's another paradigm, little jump off. Mm-hmm. So interdependent life is also guaranteed life. The life we receive will never bring disease again. Mm. His life is kept in me and my life in him. Here's what I love. In Israel, they pictured this, and this is a beautiful picture. When the tabernacle was constructed, and Moses came down with the second set of 10 words, where did those 10 words go?
Stone tablet.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the Ark of the Covenant.
They went to the Ark of the Covenant, right? You do realize, and we always misrepresented, that there were two exact replicas of, right? So it's not
five,
it's not 1 through 5 and 6 through 10. It's two of the same. The reason being, it's a covenant. Each party gets a copy of the covenant. Here's your sign of the contract, and here's your sign. What God does is he gives Moses both of them, because each of them are supposed to then put him in the most safe place in their home. And Moses gets both of them to put in the Ark of the Covenant, which says, God is here. This is his home, his safe place to be in you, and you are there. So that the Ark of the Covenant becomes this place of saying, God lives here. So that when we get to Hebrews 10, and it talks about by one offering, he's perfected for all time. And this is the covenant that I will make with them. I will put my laws, my instructions, my Torah into their heart. So that your heart becomes the Ark of the Covenant where God's presence lives. So it's this whole picture of from the Old Testament tabernacle all the way to Hebrews, saying that your heart is a medium for revealing God's presence here. That's what it means when we talk about living in there. He has put his words in me, not to be kept safe, but to be a revelation, right? That was the place of revelation. God lives here. God lives here. So, life marks we bear, which we can call our birthmarks of being in covenant relationship, the marks of a bondservant, which we've talked a lot about, the marks of a soldier. The wounds are obvious, right? If someone has been in the war, a lot of times you'll see that they've lost a leg or something. You realize that we are in the minority of Christians. Most Christians around the world actually have physical marks of martyrdom for being Christians. We don't. But do others know that I will do anything for Christ, that he is more important than my own rights? Or are we so intertwined in the culture that I'm fighting for my rights as a Christian rather than fighting for God to be seen? We talked about this with Mike Pence, right? There was such an opportunity for Mike Pence to let God be seen rather than do the fight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of us just don't know that that's, that, oh, there's another way to do this. And marks of a friend, which are marks of character, right? Compassion, humility, vulnerability. Lastly, one of the things when my kids lived in Syria is they both came home and told me that in Syria, most Christians are tattooed. Really cool. They are tattooed right here. And the reason they are tattooed, Chris, I made sure, and I talked to Chris, Christian was here this weekend, and I said, why the tattoos? And he said, they wanted it to know that when they shook hands with someone, they knew whose allegiance they had. So that they saw it right here, there's a cross. This is in Syria.
They could have done the half of the fish, and then the other person would do the other.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But that was to say my allegiance.
Marks them as,
It absolutely marks them as, it could be martyr, right? There's lots of politics we could talk about in there. The one good thing about Bashar Assad is that he actually protected Christians. He protected minorities because he's a minority Muslim, so he protected Christians. But that, I think it's cool because that's where the gospel first was. Think about Damascus and all of Syria. That's where the church exploded. Mm-hmm. And they continue to burn this scar thing to say, no, this is my allegiance. This is my allegiance. And the fact that it's right there on the hand where you shake and make agreements, like when I make an agreement, think about it. If I'm going to shake my hand and make you an agreement, and I realize, oh, wait, my allegiance first is to God. So that the marks of being in covenant remind us that our preeminent relationship is a covenant relationship. Our preeminent relationship is with Christ before anything else. And that means before your kids, before your friends, before your neighbors, I'm first, I've pledged my allegiance to Christ first. And then from there, all the relationships, we'll look at that. So that being in covenant says, my heart has completely been given over to him. He's given me his heart. It's where he's put his life into my heart. Mm-hmm. Father, thank you for all you have taught us. Thank you that you have given your life for us, your pure blood, that we might live a life that is able to join in the pericritic union, but is also, Lord, able to receive that message of belonging, that we belong. And that we have the ability and the confidence to be able to go out to others to have them know they belong. May we this week be attentive to those who are forgetting that they are securely attached, to those who are just having a hard time. We pray that we would be attentive to that. We pray also, Lord, that we would be attentive to you telling us that. Thank you that you, every time we ask, Lord, show me that I belong. You are so faithful to provide. I pray that we would be recognizing that this week, that we know that we have that white stone that says, I belong to God. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.